Blog Talk Radio.
This is the program. This is Bob Kirkconnell, your host. And we're going to talk about the RFK assassination, 50 years to the day. It was on the evening of the 4th of June, 1968, that Robert F. Kennedy was shot. And he actually was shot about 15 minutes after midnight, so that would have been on the 5th. But we're doing this 50th anniversary show, and the significance of it is that it's been 15 years and we still have obfuscation. We have evidence that's disappeared, massive amounts of evidence, massive amounts that was destroyed by the Los Angeles Police Department and the FBI, to include 2,400 photographs. Among them were pictures that were actually taken in the pantry where he was shot during the whole assassination. Gone. Los Angeles Police Department said they didn't have room to store that, among other things. So there are a lot of very strange things that even 50 years later, it's really odd that you find out more 50 years later than you do. You know, the rule is the first 24 hours, and then from there on, you find out less and less. This is the other way around. 50 years later and 30 years later, we started finding out some things that indicate what really might have happened in the RFK assassination. So, you know, and I wrote the book, American Heart of Darkness. And the reason I wrote that book was that I was involved in a case of drug smuggling out of Vietnam and the bodies of military GIs killed in the line of duty that were shot, killed, blown up in Vietnam, and heroin being smuggled in their bodies into the United States. And all the evidence disappeared in that case. I went to trial in the federal court in Maryland. I personally, this is documents that I had researched the travel, who was doing what, who was paying for it. Very, very strange things that happened there that nobody was ever convicted of drugs per se. There were other lesser included offenses. One guy wearing a uniform when he was not authorized to wear one because he was in a master sergeant's uniform with orders as a courier. And he had never even been in the Army. Had an ID card just as pretty as you please and orders and all the rest. Could salute for days. You'd cut your hands on the crease of his pants. Went to court. They could not prosecute him under the Uniform Code of Military Justice because he'd never been in the Army. And the only thing he was convicted of was flying on military airplanes when he shouldn't have been, and wearing uniforms when he shouldn't have been, and things like that. But drugs? No. The evidence disappeared to this day. It's gone. I know that for a fact because I handed that evidence over to investigators who forwarded it to a court in Maryland, U.S. Registered Mail Signature Service, never got there. And nobody knows what happened to it to this day. So it doesn't surprise me to see these kinds of things go on. I'm definitely not shocked when you see 2,400 photographs who disappeared. Well, they didn't disappear. They destroyed it. They burned them in a hospital incinerator, claiming they didn't have room to keep them. Along with a door jamb that had bullet holes in it, and ceiling panels that had bullet holes in them. Oh, we don't have room to keep that. Destroyed evidence while there were appeals processes still going on, which is illegal. But that doesn't seem to matter either. But the thing that was odd with me, and this is back to the smuggling of drugs, is that I never stopped really investigating that case, even though it went to court and was disposed of. My whole life, I always just wondered, who would do that kind of thing? Is this a mafia that can come up with a guy with perfect orders and fun sites and everything else, transportation documents and numbers that are very complex, the fiscal year, who's paying for it, and where the shipment started and where it ended up and all that? Who can forge these kind of things? Come to find out, the ID card that the guy had wasn't a forgery. It had been taken out of the ID card blanks, and this guy's picture and name and information and all that had been typed on it, and the thing laminated and all that, just like any, just as perfect as you please. It wasn't a forgery. It was an ID card that was misused. Nobody seemed to be able to find out too much about that either. But the connection with the RFK assassination from this drug smuggling, which you wouldn't think there were any, was that RFK, JFK, Martin Luther King, all these people that were assassinated, one thing they had in common is that they were shutting down the Vietnam War. And among other things, the drug trade out of Southeast Asia, out of the Golden Triangle there, where it was over 90% of the world's opium came from, was dependent on that war to smuggle drugs. You can, when you've got wars going on, you can say customs can't check this plane because it's classified, and you know, that's the CIA's plane, and all these things that go on that under the fog of war, you can smuggle a lot of drugs, and there were hundreds of tons of heroin coming into the United States, and opium products. You know, this was one way that it got in there, but it was coming in household goods, all sorts of ways that it was coming in, and very little of it was ever caught, confiscated. And you could keep this drug trade going as long as you keep the war going. Well, RFK is one that probably would have shut down that war, along with his brother and the others that I mentioned, that actually had enough following and enough moral leadership to shut that war down. It wasn't the only reason, but it was a biggie. Now, if you're talking about almost pure heroin that was coming out of Southeast Asia, you're talking about something that's 5 to 7 times more valuable per ounce than pure gold. And is a lot easier to smuggle. and worth, you know, think of it as five or seven times more valuable than gold. And you see that you're talking about tons of this stuff, tens of tons, at least 60 tons a year of this heroin coming in. And we're not even talking about all the opium that went other places and all that and all the derivatives. But you're talking about a sizable fraction of $1 trillion a year in revenue. That's nothing to sneeze at. That stuff is valuable. And these people that were dealing in it, you know, what you can do with that money if you're a central intelligence agency, who is the largest drug cartel in the world, you can also, and they control a lot of guns. We've talked about that before, where we find out that these assault weapons, sometimes they're called, but they're military-style weapons designed to kill people that are now sold to civilians all over the place, that the companies involved in this were CIA fronts. And now you can buy a whole lot of guns. You can make money off the guns. You make money off the dope. You can overthrow governments. You can assassinate presidents. You can assassinate anybody you want. This is an enormous amount of money. You don't have to you know, there's nobody going to audit you because you're not even supposed to have it. And so that is a big player. Not the only thing. No, there was a military-industrial complex. There's a national security state is what I call it, that Eisenhower called the military-industrial complex. Yeah, there were other factors in there, but all of them, it's not that they're different things. They're all like a synergy, a synergistic relationship between guns, drugs, and all these nefarious things. And I mean, you can add to it global pornography, pedophilia rings, on and on, that is operating and operating in the saying that they're doing us a favor or protecting the United States. And that there's investigative agencies, intelligence agencies, and all that, that are, they have good people working for them. But at the very top of these agencies, the people in really key positions are not good people. And we're starting to see some of this because it's starting to come out. But that's why we're doing this program. It's 50 years now. And we've got all these people that have been investigating this, and people that have caught hell about that. You know, I can't thank enough some of the people that have been involved in this, like the lawyers. William Pepper is one of them that he got a judgment in court with the King family that the United agencies of the United States government were responsible for the death of Martin Luther King. And he did that on his own. This is pro bono. This guy's spending his own money. You've got Lori Dusick, who is now, and she's handled appeals along with William Pepper, who's working on that case right now. She's another lawyer that... she's just a dedicated person that is probably going broke doing some of these things. Some of these lawyers and psychologists that have examined Sirhan, and these are nobody does that kind of thing. You know, they keep accusing these people that they're narcissistic and they're trying to make a name for themselves. And a bunch of crap. These people are dedicated, honest citizens, our best people that are being harassed by agencies and the Internal Revenue Service and other agencies. for doing the right thing, doing what anybody that an American should be thinking about doing or helping. And they're very competent people, very honest people. And I can't thank them enough. And I believe it's Dan Brown, PhD in psychology, an absolute world-class expert, maybe the top man in hypnoprogramming and post-hypnotic suggestion. He's trying to recover, and he's recovered some of Sirhan's memory. And it's quite interesting. A lot of these people, you can see their work on Facebook. The Assassination of Bobby Kennedy is the name of their Facebook site. It's a public group. That's the name of the group, is The Assassination of Bobby Kennedy. And they have put on there the actual appeals they have lodged with Sirhan on his appeals, and they've handled them through the courts. And the response to the appeals and the denials and all of this, and I mean, you can see these documents, and it's quite lengthy, but. There's Al out there telling me I'm fading in and out, and I was moving my head. I was looking at something there, and I hope that's all the fading in and out that we're doing. Al will tell me if we're doing okay now, but thanks for the heads up there, Al. And there are others. You know, some of the books that I've used in research, and let's see if I can look at some of these. The Assassinations is a good one, and that's Lisa Pease and Jim DiEugenio, and they have done, and it was RFK, JFK, Martin Luther King, Malcolm X, and in one book they have that thing packed with just incredible kind of research that they have done. That is extremely well done, and these two are very adept at not only analyzing things but synthesizing. Are there ramifications of it? Coming to conclusions that they're probably as good as any. Shane O'Sullivan, Who Killed Bobby, is the name of his book, and he's done all sorts of interviews and videos and the research that he's done, and it's gumshoe. He's gone and interviewed people, showed them pictures, put cases together on this thing that is really just incredible work he's done. There's also Fernando Fara, and his book was The Polka Dot File. And he went way into this, and we'll talk about this, but the case, some of the very mysterious things with a whole, I think it was at least 13 witnesses, and there were probably more, that saw this girl in a polka dot dress that was engaged in very suspicious behavior. And Sirhan is one that identified and said that this girl is the one who led him to the pantry where Robert Kennedy was shot, and that she had touched him in a certain way on his right shoulder. And I believe he said that she had pinched him, and he didn't remember anything after that. Some of his memory has been recovered, But Fernando has done some outstanding work there. And if Fernando has passed away, it was tragic. We're really sorry to hear that. Jay Margolis and Richard, oh my goodness, let me see if I can get his name here. Their book was the... The Murder of Marilyn Monroe, Case Closed, But they had an addendum, I believe it was, that they put on there that was quite lengthy about the RFK assassination. I think specifically it had to do with, let me see here. Darn it. Let me get his name again and I'll get the cover of this book. Oh, my. Let's see here. Yeah, Richard Buskin. It might be pronounced Buskin. I think, yeah, Buskin. J. Margolius in The Murder of Marilyn Monroe. But they had the addendum they put on there, and I can't remember whether it was specifically just to, I think it was more than the polka dot. Well, but they had done some wonderful research there. And I must say that not all these people, the researchers, all of them agree on everything, and it's not really agreement. Sometimes, you know, you do things and you go where things take you, and sometimes it might end up that most of it is true, but you got something wrong somewhere. And it's not that sometimes you get it wrong, but you know, there are some cases where some of these people have interviewed witnesses who said something that panned out that it couldn't be, that somebody had been already died or something like that, and couldn't have been at a certain place at a certain time. But that's not the researchers' fault. That's, you know, somebody who's, sometimes people are mistaken. Sometimes they tell a researcher something that they misread something. These happen. This is what happens in an investigation. And all of these people have done just really great work. And that's not, and I did want to mention too that Fernando Farah, there was one picture he reenacted of the polka dot girl to see whether witnesses would say this is what she looked like. And I think I put that picture on some of the, on my page there. When you go to listen to this program, you'll see these pictures up, and the one with the girl in the polka dot dress, and it's the back of her going through a doorway in high heels. That apparently a lot of the witnesses said, yeah, that's what she looked like. And so he had done that, and I used that picture. And any of those pictures that I put up there, they're just the kind of thing associated with this case. And, of course, I would not use them in a book or publish them in a book without making sure, you know, at least sometimes some things can be called, you know, or used as fair use. But if I can get a hold of somebody that actually owns a picture or has a, I will ask them, even though I might be able to use it, I will try and get a hold of them, though, even when I'm pretty sure it's legal, just as a courtesy. Let's see, I can't, oh, yeah, there's also, let's see, RFK Beyond a Question of Conspiracy, an Investigation and a Revision of History. And that was, let's see, that was done by Ralph Thomas. And Ralph did an excellent job on that book. And he did it like an investigator. This is who did what, where, when, and how, and why. And he laid it out like you would an investigation. Excellent book. And so, I appreciate that. And I appreciate these lawyers, these psychologists. And I probably didn't mention all of them, of course, but all of these people, very brave people that have sacrificed quite a bit just because it's the right thing to do. And, you've got my admiration. Those people, and all of the people that are involved in that that site, the assassination of Bobby Kennedy, and that is on Facebook. These are really some good people, and thank you. So back to this case, and I think it's worthwhile to go into all these things, and they call this the Kennedys, the curse of the Kennedys. And you hear this all the time. Those Kennedys, they've just bad luck. And, well, it's really not. I went into this in some detail in my second book, especially. I got a subtitle in my second chapter that is the curse of the Kennedys. And really to understand what happened to RFK and the Ambassador Hotel on June 5th, you got to understand that, this is the way I look at it. Anyway, we've got people say, well, organized crime killed John F. Kennedy and organized crime did this. Well, yeah, organized crime killed all these people, but I consider that there are four branches of organized crime in American society. One is the one that everybody associates with, the mafia. But big business, I believe, is organized crime, organized religion, and politics. These are branches of organized crime to me that operate in a lot of times in very similar fashion. You know, when you've got the mafia, you don't tell on somebody or they'll kill you. Well, these people do the same kind of things in politics and government. And we see this over and over again. There were over 100 witnesses in JFK assassination that ended up dying under suspicious circumstances. And a lot of them right before they were ready to testify to House Select Committee on Assassinations, the Warren Commission, or whatever, the deaths skyrocketed. There were people definitely threatened, probably killed, with the Robert Kennedy assassination. If somebody wanted to say, well, I don't think it was a guy, I think it was organized crime. Well, the government is organized crime. That's the way I look at it. And we'll compare and contrast some of those rules, you know, as we go. But the people in government will do away with somebody that is a threat to them or a threat to the organization. They do carry out assassinations within the government. This whole thing with the curse of the Kennedys, it started with Joseph P. Kennedy Sr., who was an extremely ambitious man. He was rich, although not near as rich as like the Rockefellers and people like that. He developed quite a bit of wealth, and he was seen as an aggressive, independent, self-made man, determined to either put himself in the White House or his first son, which was Joseph Jr., whom he had been grooming, his first son, all of his life for president of the United States. One thing about the Kennedys, and they all got this probably from Joseph Sr., if he set his sights on something, he fully intended to see it done. And we see that same trait in JFK. We saw it in Robert Kennedy. We even see it now in Robert Kennedy Jr. You see him out there. If he thinks something is a certain way, he'll flat tell you about it. We see this as a family trait. And I believe this is one thing that that marked this family, that they could not be controlled. They had enough money to where they didn't have to rely on donations, and they didn't have to answer to anybody. And I think Robert Kennedy was a somebody who was part of this heritage. And Senior Joseph Senior, having made a fortune in business, he entered the realm of politics with a determination of cold steel, which some would say was ruthless, and there might be something to that. He was a U.S. ambassador to the United Kingdom from 1938 to 1940, and that was a crucial time in the run-up to the U.S. entry in World War II. President FDR, Franklin Delano Roosevelt, and British Prime Minister Winston Churchill were working very hard to bring the U.S. material and financial support into the war on the side of Great Britain. They were laying the foundation for a U.S. declaration of war against Nazi Germany. At the time, the U.S. was still in the throes of the Great Depression, and there was a strong isolationist sentiment and resistance to the war. It turned out that Joe Kennedy Sr., and I researched this pretty good, he was strongly and openly opposed to the U.S. entry in World War II, and further, he was opposed to U.S. aid to Great Britain, and he publicly said so. And this was while he was ambassador to Great Britain, a U.S. ambassador. And FDR believed that Joe Senior's behavior was treasonous, especially when he independently met with Hitler without advising or even coordinating with Churchill or the State Department. Roosevelt was howling mad about this and never forgave him. Add to this, Winston Churchill and a great many of the British people were also not impressed. In fact, they said so. They made a lot of cartoon characters and things like that of Kennedy hiding in bunkers while the British people are getting bombed and things like that. And I guess there was one time that there was a city going to be bombed and started to be bombed, and Kennedy just hauled out of there and left the city, and there were the British people did not appreciate Joseph Kennedy Sr. very much. And Joseph Kennedy Jr., he published articles opposing FDR's third run for election. He publicly opposed it. And there are indications that FDR and other influential people in politics decided that no one named Kennedy would ever occupy the White House under any circumstances. And although the Kennedys were experienced in the machinations of politics, they were no match for the likes of FDR. He was in a different league. And back to the mafia, similar mafia concept of it's not personal, it's business. The political branch of organized crime is quite capable of removing someone, as it referred to in politics. The mafia calls this mercy killing. You can read The Godfather, some of that's in there. But this is the mentality is like the mafia. Anyone who talks about this is in jeopardy in both political parties or the mafia. The term the mafia uses omerta, O-M-E-R-T-A. That's a Sicilian word for silence, and you got to maintain silence. Well, Joe Kennedy Sr. was not maintaining silence, and FDR saw fit to see that Joe Sr. resigned from office, and There was also this eerie coincidence that Joe Kennedy Jr. was tragically killed while flying an experimental mission to blow up a Nazi missile site occupied France. Joe was a Navy bomber, and the mission was to fly a bomber loaded with, I think it was something like 21,000 pounds of Torpex high explosives into a Nazi submarine pens at Elegio Island, I think it was, in the North Sea. And the pilot and co-pilot were supposed to bail out shortly after they took off from England. And the plane was then to be remote control guided in to blow up the submarine installation. The plane with Joe Kennedy Jr. and co-pilot on it, unexplainably, let me use that word. I don't know why I'm having trouble, inexplicably. But it blew up over a village in Blytheburg, Suffolk, England. Killed both Kennedy and the co-pilot. I note here, there was a time, quite a while ago when I had quite a bit of experience in training and handling explosives. And this incident always did, even when I was young, in my 20s, I found this incident very curious. That high explosives, they just don't go off like that. They're very difficult. They go off the way they're designed to go off. And a priming or initiating device is just got to be activated. There might be some real extreme exceptions, but when you talk about a plane flying level and all of a sudden 21,000 pounds of high explosives go off, it just doesn't happen. So, on the face of it, that was pretty suspicious. Kennedy biographer Arthur Schlesinger, he took notice of that also, although he came to no conclusions that he would print anyway. He wrote that Joe Sr. was visited a few weeks after his son's death by vice presidential candidate Harry Truman, and Joe Kennedy Sr. made the following comment. Let's see if I got that comment. Here it is, I think. Harry, and he's talking about Harry Truman. Harry, what the hell are you doing campaigning for that crippled son of a bitch who killed my son Joe? And I think probably Joe Kennedy Sr. thought there was some connection there. Schlesinger added a note to that stated among the witnesses of the midair explosion was Colonel Elliot Roosevelt, son of FDR, accompanying the mission in a Mosquito. And he simply says the lives of the two families were curiously intertwined. So he kind of hinted that there might be more to it, although he didn't say that. There was somebody else who was a lot more candid about this incident, and that was CIA Deputy Director of Clandestine Operations Robert Turnbull Crowley, who told Gregory Douglas. Now, some people don't care for him a whole lot, but I think in this instance that the report is accurate. Well, I don't want to talk about the controversy with Gregory Douglas, but anyway, here's what he wrote that Crowley had told him. Here's Robert Crowley. True enough, Joe wanted to run his oldest for the White House, but Roosevelt put a spoke into that plan. Franklin wanted to die in office, and Gregory Douglas asked him, which he did. And Robert Crowley says, and the eldest son had a fatal accident in England. And Douglas says, I know, I covered that in my first book. And here's what Robert Crowley told him, or at least this is what Douglas says. The kid was supposed to pilot a plane full of explosives to a German V-bombs base, parachute out, and let the plane blow it up. Churchill, ever a good friend when Franklin was alive, and given him support, arranged for a radio station near the airfield to send out a trigger code and blew young Kennedy into cat meat. One hand washes the other, doesn't it? So, you know, I've heard rumors and seen things about this, but there apparently was, especially with Churchill, that people he didn't care for seemed to have a whole lot of plane accidents. And, you know, I have found pretty good evidence that he might have arranged for some people to not land, take off and not land. And post-war, World War II, Joe Sr. was not allowed to pursue anything that could lead to the presidency. He established that he would not acquiesce to anybody, and he's passed this characteristic on to his children, especially his sons. He'd also created a powerful sense of suspicion and outright hostility toward the Kennedy name in many powerful people. This antipathy for the Kennedys became institutionalized. Deep politics feared and was contemptuous of the Kennedys from World War II to today. Local politics was open to them, and even any national office was just fine, except the big one. For the Kennedys, the White House was off limits. Now, another development along that line was the advent of what became known as the national security state, although it's not, it wasn't called that right away. The core of this is a Central Intelligence Agency that evolved from a World War II Office of Strategic Services, or OSS. And these were the old spies from the war who had fallen in love with the excitement and intrigue of practicing spycraft during wartime. This love of war and spycraft can't be underestimated. Peace was something that was not only boring, but too much of it would put them out of a job. These old spies were only dedicated to perpetuation of war and violent conflict. They were, and to this day, I wouldn't call them immoral. I would call them amoral. They just, anything that gets in the way of them perpetrating war and destruction and world domination, they consider to be treason. And they take that seriously. As I wrote in my first book, these are not very talented people. They're cunning, they're crafty, they're ruthless, but they're not particularly talented. So if they're not doing all this spycraft, spy versus spy stuff and wartime thing and all this intrigue, they can't make a living on their own other than that. That's all they know how to do. And so they will do anything to stay in business. And this explains a lot. I mean, this explains anybody that wants to shut down wars or actually can do that ends up to have some serious health problems, as we know. RFK was one of them. Destruction and conquest is all they value, and that's what they know. They have no other talent. And so, you know, they have to keep going at any cost. The Cold War, Korean.
Hey, how you doing? Hello? Hello?